So today's session, I thought I would continue the storytelling. I'm going to try to switch it up so that every day I won't be doing the same sort of thing. I'll try to do one day a week, at least doing a sutta study where we actually study the discourses of the Buddha, and try to do at least one day a week giving a talk about meditation practice. And one day a week on various other things, including today I'll be doing a story of one of the Buddha's past lives and sort of explaining it a little bit as I go along. So this story is on the perfection of patience. On the perfection of renunciation, on giving up one's interest in delightful things or pleasurable things or intoxicating things, giving up our delight in sensuality. And this is a theme that sort of runs through Buddhist practice, where we're trying to not denounce worldly pleasures, but simply renounce our interest in them, to give no interest or no attention to them, to not live our lives striving after sensual pleasure. And this is something that has gone against the way of the world since time immemorial, where we've taken it as a part of our cultures, a part of our society, that sensual pleasure is a source of true and lasting happiness. And so our goals and our strivings very often have to do directly with our attainment of happiness, either in this world or in the next. And so here we have a story sort of exemplifying this idea of, first of all, the fact that these sensual pleasures, when indulged in, don't lead to happiness. They in fact lead to a lot of unwholesome deeds, a lot of bad deeds, a lot of evil deeds, and hence a lot of suffering, both for oneself and for other people. That because of our greed and our attachment to these things, will very often give rise to immorality, hurting other people, trying to get what we want. Even our own friends and family, this is why people fight, why families are always constantly nagging and bickering. It's because of our attachment to delightful or pleasurable things, and then when something is not the way we want it, not the way we think it should be, not the way we would like it to be, we get angry and upset. It's an interesting fact that the more someone is addicted to a pleasant thing, the more irritated and angry they will be at an unpleasant experience. And so this story, I think, exemplifies it to a perfection. And these stories are all about the Buddha's perfections. The Buddha was perfect in so many different ways. And one of the ways he was perfect was in his renunciation, his ability to give up everything. So the Jataka stories are, first of all, it's important to understand, they're based on verses. So this story is based on the verse starting with, "Show no intelligence," and so on. And the verse will come later on, but the story starts with a piece of the verse that's, "Show no intelligence." This story the master told the Buddha at Jetavana, which was the monastery donated by Anathapindika, which is near the city of Sawatthi, which you can still find today in India. It was told concerning the great renunciation. One day the brethren seated in the hall of Dhamma were discussing the praises of the Blessed One's great renunciation, where the Buddha had left behind a kingdom, left behind potential rulership over India or over the area where he was living, great wealth and opulence. He left it all solely for the purpose of becoming free, of becoming enlightened. When the Buddha came and inquired of the brethren what was the topic which they were discussing as they sat there, on hearing what it was, he said, "No, brethren, this my renunciation of the world, after leaving my kingdom, was not wonderful, when I had fully exercised the perfections. For before, even when my wisdom was still immature, and while I was still attaining the perfections, I also left my kingdom and renounced the world." And at their request, the Buddha told them a story of the past. Once upon a time, a king Kasiraja ruled justly in Benares. He had 16,000 wives, but not one among them conceived either son or daughter. Now, it's important to understand the word 16,000 is one of these wonderful overestimations by the commentators, and it probably wasn't the case that he had 16,000 wives, but it just means a lot. Maybe 16 is more like it. The citizens assembled, as in another story, saying, "Our king has no son to keep up his line," and they begged the king to pray for a son. The king commanded his 16,000 wives to pray for sons, but though they worshipped the moon and other deities and prayed, they obtained none. Now his chief queen, Chanda Devi, the daughter of the king of the Madhas, was devoted to good works, and he asked her also to pray for a son. So on the day of the full moon, she took upon herself the Uposatha vows, this is the 8 precepts which we keep as Buddhist meditators, and while lying on a little bed, a low bed, as she reflected on her virtuous life, she made an act of truth in these terms: "If I have never broken the commandments, by the truth of this, my protestation, may a son be born to me." Through the power of her piety, Sakka's dwelling became hot. Sakka is the king of the angels. Sakka, having considered and ascertained the cause, said, "Chanda Devi asks for a son. I will give her one." So, as he looked for a suitable son, he saw the Bodhisatta. Now, the Bodhisatta, after having reigned 20 years in Benares, had been reborn in the Usada hell, where he had suffered for 80,000 years, and had then been born in the world of the 33 gods, and after staying there his allotted period, he had passed away therefrom, and was desirous of going to the world of the higher gods. Sakka went up to him and said, "Friend, if you are born in the world of men, you will fully exercise the perfections, and the mass of mankind will be advantaged. Now this chief queen of Kasiraja, Chanda, is praying for a son. Do you be born in her womb." The Bodhisatta consented and came attended by 500 deities and was himself conceived in her womb, while the other deities were conceived in the wombs of the wives of the king's ministers. The queen's womb seemed to be full of diamond. When she became aware of it, she told it to the king, who caused every care to be taken for the safety of the unborn child. And at last she brought forth a son endued with auspicious marks. On the same day, 500 young nobles were born in the ministers' houses. At that moment, the king was seated on his royal dais, surrounded by his ministers, when it was announced, "A son is born to thee, O king." At hearing it, paternal affection arose, and piercing through his skin reached to the marrow of his bones. Joy sprang up within him, and his heart became refreshed. He asked his ministers, "Are you glad at the birth of my son?" "What art thou saying, sire?" they answered. "We were before helpless. Now we have a help. We have obtained a lord." The king gave orders to his chief general. "A retinue must be prepared for my son. Find out how many young nobles have been born today in the ministers' houses." He saw the 500 and went and told it to the king. The king sent princely dresses of honor for the 500 young nobles, and he also sent 500 nurses. He gave, moreover, 64 nurses for the Bodhisatta, all free from the faults of being too tall and so on, with their breasts not hanging down and full of sweet milk. If a child drinks milk sitting on the hip of a nurse who is too tall, its neck will become too long. If it sits on the hip of one too short, its shoulder bone will be compressed. If the nurse be too thin, the babe's thighs will ache. If too stout, the babe will become bow-legged. The body of a very dark nurse is too cold, of one very white is too hot. The children who drink the milk of a nurse with hanging breasts have the ends of their noses flattened. This is a very interesting synopsis of a good nurse. I suppose it's a little bit of beside the point, but the commentator goes on and on about this. Some nurses have their milk sour, others have it bitter, etc. Therefore, avoiding all these faults, he provided 64 nurses, all possessed with sweet milk and without any of these faults. And after paying the bodhisattva great honor, he also gave the queen a boon, a wish. She accepted it and kept it in her mind. On the day of naming the child, they paid great honor to the Brahmins, who read the different marks and inquired if there were any danger threatening. They, the Brahmins, beholding the excellence of his marks, replied, O king, the prince possesses every mark of future good fortune. He is able to rule not one continent only, but all the four. There is no danger visible. The king, being pleased, when he fixed the boy's name, gave him the name Temya Kumaro, since it had rained all over the kingdom of Kasi on the day of his birth, and he had been born wet. Temya, I guess, means one who is wet. When he was 1 month old, they adorned him and brought him to the king, and the king, having looked at his dear child, embraced him and placed him on his hip and sat playing with him. Now at that time, four robbers were brought before him. One of them he sentenced to receive 1,000 strokes from whips barbed with thorns, another to be imprisoned in chains, a third to be smitten with a spear, the fourth to be impaled. The bodhisattva, on hearing his father's words, was terrified and thought to himself, Ah! My father, through his being a king, is becoming guilty of a grievous action, which brings men to hell. And he remembered this because he himself had recently come from hell to be reborn in heaven, and from heaven then born as the prince. The next day they laid him on a sumptuous bed under a white umbrella, and he woke after a short sleep, and opening his eyes, beheld the white umbrella and the royal pomp, and his fear increased all the more. And as he pondered, From whence have I come into this palace? By his recollection of his former births, he remembered that he had once come from the world of the gods, and that after that he had suffered in hell, and that then he had been a king in that very city. When he pondered to himself, I was a king for 20 years, and then I suffered 80,000 years in the Usada hell, and now again I am born in this house of robbers, and my father, when four robbers were brought before him, uttered such a cruel speech as must lead to hell. If I become a king, I shall be born again in hell and suffer great pain there. He became greatly alarmed. His golden body became pale and faded like a lotus, crushed by the hand, and he lay thinking how he could escape from that house of robbers. Then a goddess who dwelt in the umbrella, an angel, and who in a certain previous birth had been his mother, comforted him. Fear not, my child Temya, if you really desire to escape, then pretend to be a cripple, although not really one. Though not deaf, pretend to be deaf. And, though not dumb, pretend to be dumb. Putting on these characteristics, show no signs of intelligence. So she uttered the first stanza of this Jataka. Show no intelligence, my child, be as a fool in all men's eyes. Content to be the scorn of all, thus shalt thou gain at last the prize. Being comforted by her words, he uttered the second stanza. O goddess, I will do thy will. What thou commandest me is best. Mother, thou wishest for my weal. Thou longest but to see me blessed. And so he practiced these three characteristics. The king, in order that his son might lose his melancholy, had the 500 young nobles brought near him. The children began crying for their milk, but the bodhisattva, being afraid of hell, reflected that to die of thirst would be better than to reign as king, and did not cry. The nurses told this to Queen Chanda, and she told it to the king. He sent for some Brahmins skilled in signs and omens and consulted them. They replied, Sire, you must give the prince his milk after the proper time has passed. He will then cry and seize the breast eagerly and drink of his own accord. So they gave him his milk after letting the proper time pass by, and sometimes they let it pass by for once, and sometimes they did not give it to him at all through the day. But he, stung by the fear of hell, even though thirsty, would not cry for milk. Then the mother or the nurses gave him milk, though he did not cry for it, saying, The boy is famished. The other children cried when they did not get their milk, but he neither cried nor slept, nor doubled up his hands nor feet, nor would he hear a sound. Then his nurses reflected, "The hands and feet of cripples are not like this. The formation of the jaws of the dumb are not like this. The structure of the ears of the deaf is not like this. There must be some reason for all this. Let us examine into it." So they determined to try him with milk, and so for one whole day they gave him no milk. But, though parched, he uttered no sound for milk. Then his mother said, "My boy is famished, give him milk." And she made them give him milk. Thus, giving him milk at intervals, they spent a year in trying him, but they did not discover his weak point. Then, saying, "The other children are fond of cakes and dainties, we will try him with them." They set the 500 children near him and brought various dainties and placed them close by him. And, telling him to take what they liked, they hid themselves. The other children quarreled and struck one another and seized the cakes and ate them. But the Bodhisattva said to himself, "O Tamiya, eat the cakes and dainties if you wish for hell." And so in his fear of hell he would not look at them. Thus, even though they tried him with cakes and dainties for a whole year, they discovered not his weak point. Then they said, "Children are fond of different kinds of fruit," and they brought all sorts of fruit and tried him. The other children fought for them and ate them, but he would not look at them, and thus for a whole year they tried him with various kinds of fruit. Then they said, "Other children are fond of playthings," so they set golden and other figures of elephants near him. The rest of the children seized them as if they were spoil, but the Bodhisattva would not look at them, and thus for a whole year they tried him with playthings. So the idea is they're trying different ways to get him to say or hear something. Then they said, "There is a special food for children 4 years old. We will try him with that." So they brought all sorts of food. The other children broke them in pieces and ate them, but the Bodhisattva said to himself, "O Tamiya, there is no counting of the past births when you did not obtain food." And for fear of hell he did not look at them. Until at last his mother, with her heart well nigh rent, fed him with her own hand. Then they said, "Children 5 years old are afraid of fire. We will try him with that." So, having a large house made with many doors, and having covered it over with palm leaves, they set him in the middle, surrounded by the other children, and set fire to it. The others ran away shrieking, but the Bodhisattva said to himself that it was better than the torture in hell to stay with this fire, that this fire was better than the torture in hell, and remained motionless as if perfectly apathetic. And when the fire came near him, they took him away. Then they said, "Children 6 years old are afraid of a wild elephant." So they had a well-trained elephant taught, and when they had seated the Bodhisattva with the other children in the palace courtyard, they let it loose. On it came, trumpeting and striking the ground with its trunk and spreading terror. The other children fled in all directions in fear for their lives. But the Bodhisattva, being afraid of hell, sat where he was. And the well-trained animal took him and lifted him up and down and went away without hurting him. When he was 7 years old, as he was sitting surrounded by his companions, they let loose some serpents with their teeth extract and their mouths bound. The other children ran away shrieking, but the Bodhisattva, remembering the fear of hell, remained motionless, saying, "It is better to perish by the mouth of a fierce serpent." Then the serpents enveloped his whole body, and they spread their hoods on his head, but still he remained motionless. Thus, though they tried him again and again, they still could not discover his weak point. Then they said, "Boys are fond of social gatherings." So having set him in the palace court with the 500 boys, they caused an assembly of mimes to be gathered together. The other boys, seeing the mimes, shouted, "Bravo!" and laughed loudly. But the Bodhisattva, saying to himself that if he were born in hell, he would never have a moment's laughter or joy, remained motionless as he pondered on hell, and never looked at the dancing. Thus, trying him again and again, they discovered no weak point in him. Then they said, "We will try him with the sword." So they placed him with the other boys in the palace court, and while they were playing, a man rushed upon them, brandishing a sword like crystal, and shouting and jumping, saying, "Where is this devil's child of the king of Kasi? I will cut off his head." The others fled, shrieking in terror at the sight of him. But the Bodhisattva, having pondered on the fear of hell, sat as if unconscious. The man, although he rubbed the sword on his head and threatened to cut it off, could not frighten the bodhisattva, and at last went away. Thus, though they tried him again and again, they could not discover his weak point. When he was 10 years old, in order to try whether he was really deaf, they hung a curtain round a bed and made holes in the four sides and placed conch blowers underneath, without letting him see them. All at once they blew the conches. There was one burst of sound, but the ministers, though they stood at the four sides and watched by the holes in the curtain, could not through a whole day detect in him any confusion of thought or any disturbance of hand or foot, or even a single start. So, after a year had passed, they tried him for another year with drums. But even thus, though they tried him again and again, they could not discover his weak point. Then they said, "We will try him with a lamp." So in the night time, in order to see whether he moved hand or foot in the darkness, they lighted some lamps in jars, and having extinguished all the other lamps, they put these down for a while in the darkness, and then, suddenly lifting the lamps in the jars, created all at once a blaze, and watched his behavior. But though they thus tried him again and again for a whole year, they never saw him start even once. Then they said, "We will try him with molasses." So they smeared all his body with molasses and laid him in a place infested with flies and stirred the flies up. These covered his whole body and bit it as if they were piercing it with needles, but he remained motionless as if perfectly apathetic. Thus they tried him for a year, but they discovered no weak point in him. Then when he was 14 years old, they said, "This youth, now he is grown up, loves what is clean and abhors what is unclean. We will try him with what is unclean." So from that time on, they did not let him bathe or rinse his mouth or perform any bodily ablutions, until he was reduced to a miserable plight, and he looked like a released prisoner. As he lay covered with flies, the people came round and reviled him, saying, "O Tamia, you are grown up now. Who is to wait on you? Are you not ashamed? Why are you lying there? Rise up and cleanse yourself." But he, remembering the torments of the Helgutha, lay quietly in his squalor, and though they tried him again and again for a year, they discovered no weak point in him. Then they put pans of fire in the bed under him, saying, "When he is distressed by the heat, he will perhaps be unable to bear the pain, and will show some signs of writhing." Boils seemed to break out all over his body, but the bodhisattva resigned himself, saying, "The fire of the hell Avicii flames up 100 leagues. This heat is 100,000 times preferable to that." So he remained motionless. Then his parents, with breaking hearts, made the men come back and took him out of the fire, and implored him, saying, "O Prince Tamia, we know that thou art not in any way crippled by birth, for cripples have not such feet, face, or ears as thou hast. We gained thee as our child after many prayers. Do not now destroy us, but deliver us from the blame of all the kings of Jambudipa." But though thus entreated by them, he lay still motionless, as if he heard them not. Then his parents went away weeping. And sometimes his father or his mother came back alone and implored him, and thus they tried him again and again for a whole year, but they discovered no weak point in him. Then, when he was 16 years old, they considered, "Whether it be a cripple or deaf or dumb, there still are none who, when they are grown up, do not delight in what is enjoyable and dislike what is disagreeable. This is all natural in the proper time, like the opening of flowers. We will have some dramas acted before him and will thus try him." So they summoned some women full of all graces and as beautiful as the daughters of the angels, and they promised that whichever of them could make the prince laugh or could entangle him in sinful thoughts should become his principal queen. Then they had the prince bathed in perfumed water and adorned like a son of the angels, and laid on a royal bed prepared in a suite of royal chambers like the dwellings of the gods, and having filled his inner chamber with a mingled fragrance of perfumed wreaths of flowers, incense, unguents, spirituous liquor, and the like, they retired. Meanwhile, the women surrounded him and tried hard to delight him with dancing and singing and all sorts of pleasant words. But he looked at them in his perfect wisdom and stopped his inhalations and exhalations in fear lest they should touch his body, so that his body became quite rigid. They, being unable to touch him, said to his parents, "His body is all rigid. He is not a man, but must be a goblin."
Thus his parents, though they tried him again and again, discovered no weak point in him. Thus, though they tried him for 16 years with the 16 great tests and many smaller ones, they were not able to detect a weak point in him. Then the king, being full of vexation, summoned the fortune-tellers and said, "When the prince was born, ye said that he has fortunate and auspicious marks. He has no threatening obstacles, but he is born a cripple and deaf and dumb. Your words do not answer to the facts." "Great king," they replied, "nothing is unseen by your teachers, but we knew how grieved you would be if we told you that the child of so many royal prayers would be all ill luck, so we did not utter it." This is the way of fortune tellers, to find a new excuse for every problem in their prognosis. You know. "What must be done now?" the king asked. "O king, if this prince remains in this house, three dangers are threatened. That is, your life, your royal power, or your queen. Therefore, it will be best to have some unlucky horses yoked to an unlucky chariot, and, placing him therein, to convey him by the western gate and bury him in the charnel ground." The king assented, being frightened at the threatening dangers. When the queen, Janda Devi, heard the news, she came to the king. "My lord, you gave me a boon, and I have kept it unclaimed. Give it to me now." "Take it, O queen." "Give the kingdom to my son," she replied. "I cannot, O queen. Thy son is all ill luck." "Then if you cannot, or will not, give it for his life, give it to him for 7 years." "I cannot, O queen." "Then give it to him for 6 years, for 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 year. Give it to him for 7 months, for 6, 5, 4, 3, 2 month, 1 month, for half a month." "I cannot, O queen." "Then give it to him for 7 days. "Well," said the king, "take your boon." So she had her son adorned, and the city being gaily decorated, a proclamation was made to the beat of a drum. "This is the reign of Prince Damia," and he was seated upon an elephant and led triumphantly rightwise around the city, with a white umbrella held over his head. When he returned and was laid on his royal bed, she implored him all the night, "O my child, Prince Damia, on thy account for 16 years I have wept and taken no sleep, and my eyes are parched up, and my heart is pierced with sorrow. I know that thou art not really a cripple or deaf or dumb. Do not make me utterly destitute." In this manner she implored him day after day for 5 days. On the 6th day the king summoned the charioteer Sunanda and said to him, "Tomorrow morning early, yoke some ill-omened horses to an ill-omened chariot, and having set the prince in it, take him out by the western gate and dig a hole with 4 sides in the charnel ground. Throw him into it and break his head with the back of the spade and kill him. Then scatter dust over him and make a heap of earth above, and after bathing yourself, come hither." That 6th night the queen implored the prince, "O my child, the king of Kasi has given orders that you are to be buried tomorrow in the charnel ground. Tomorrow you will certainly die, my son." When the bodhisattva heard this, he thought to himself, "O Tamiya, your 16 years' labor has reached its end," and he was glad. But his mother's heart was as it were, cleft in twain. Still he would not speak to her, lest his desire should not attain its end. At the end of the night, in the early morning, Sunanda, the charioteer, yoked the chariot and made it stand at the gate. And entering the royal bedchamber, he said, "O queen, be not angry, it is the king's command." So saying, as the queen lay embracing her son, he pushed her away with the back of his hand, and lifted up the prince like a bundle of flowers, and came down from the palace. The queen was left in the chamber, smiting her breast and lamenting with a loud cry. Then the bodhisattva looked at her and considered, "If I do not speak, she will die of a broken heart." But though he desired to speak, he reflected, "If I speak, my efforts for 16 years will be rendered fruitless. But if I do not speak, I shall be the saving of myself and my parents." Then the charioteer lifted him into the chariot, and saying, "I will drive the chariot to the western gate," he drove it to the eastern gate, and the wheel struck against the threshold. The bodhisattva, hearing the sound, said, "My desire has attained its end," and he became still more glad at heart. When the chariot had gone out of the city, it went a space of 3 leagues by the power of the gods, and there the end of a forest appeared to the charioteer. as if it were a charnel ground. So, thinking it to be a suitable place, he turned the chariot out of the road, and stopping it by the roadside, he alighted and took off all the bodhisattva's ornaments, and made them into a bundle and laid them down. And then, taking a spade, began to dig a hole. Then the bodhisattva thought, "This is my time for effort. For 16 years I have never moved hands nor feet. Are they in my power or not?" So he rose and rubbed his right hand with his left, and his left hand with his right, and his feet with both hands, and resolved to alight from the chariot. When his foot came down, the earth rose up like a leather bag filled with air and touched the hinder end of the chariot. When he had alighted and walked backwards and forwards several times, he felt that he had strength to go 100 leagues in this manner in one day. At that moment, Sakka's palace became hot. Sakka, having perceived the reason, said, "Prince Tamya's desire has attained its end. He desires to be adorned. What has he to do with human adornment?" And he commanded Visakamma to take heavenly decorations and go and adorn the son of the king of Kasi. So Visakamma went, Visakamma is the architect of the angels, and wrapped the prince with 10,000 pieces of cloth and adorned him like Sakka himself with heavenly and human ornaments. The prince, decked with all the bravery of the king of the gods, went up to the hole as the charioteer was digging, and standing at the edge uttered the third stanza. "Why in such haste, O charioteer, and wherefore do you dig that pit? Answer my question truthfully, with what do you want to do with it?" The charioteer went on digging the hole without looking up and spoke the fourth stanza. "Our king has found his only son, cripple and dumb, an idiot quiet, and I am sent to dig this hole and bury him far out of sight." The bodhisattva replied, "I am not deaf nor dumb, my friend, no cripple, not e'en lame am I. If in this wood you bury me, you will incur great guilt thereby. Behold these arms and legs of mine, and hear my voice and what I say. If in this wood you bury me, you will incur great guilt today." Then the charioteer said, "Who is this? It is only since I came here that he has become as he describes himself." So he left off digging the hole and looked up, and beholding his glorious beauty, and not knowing whether he was a god or a man, the charioteer spoke this stanza. "A heavenly minstrel or a god? Or art thou Sakka, lord of all? Who art thou, pray? Whose son art thou? What shall we name thee when we call?" Then the bodhisattva spoke, revealing himself and declaring the truth. "No heavenly minstrel, nor a god, nor Sakka, lord of all, am I. I am the king of Kasi's son, with whom you would bury ruthlessly. I am the son of that same king, under whose sway you serve and thrive. You will incur great guilt today, if here you bury me alive. If neath a tree I sit and rest, well, its shade and shelter lends. I would not break a single branch, only the sinner harms his friends. The sheltering tree, it is the king, I am the branch that tree has spread. And you, the traveller charioteer, who sits and rests beneath its shade, if in this wood you bury me, great guilt will fall upon your head." But though the bodhisattva said this, the man did not believe him. Then the bodhisattva resolved to convince him, and he made the woods resound with his own voice and the applause of the gods as he commenced these 10 verses in honour of friends. "He who is faithful to his friends may wander far and wide. Many will gladly wait on him. His food shall be supplied. Whatever lands he wanders through, in city or in town, he who is faithful to his friends finds honor and renown. No robbers dare to injure him, no warriors him despise. He who is faithful to his friends escapes his enemies. Welcomed by all, he home returns, no cares corrode his breast. He who is faithful to his friends is of all kin the best. He honors and is honored too, respect he takes and gives. He who is faithful to his friends full meed from all receives. He is by others honored, who to them due honor pays. He who is faithful to his friends wins himself fame and praise. Like fire he blazes brightly forth and sheds a light divine. He who is faithful to his friends will with fresh splendor shine. His oxen surely multiply, his seed unfailing grows. He who is faithful to his friends reaps surely all he sows. If from a mountain top he falls, or from a tree or grot, he who is faithful to his friends finds a sure resting spot. The banyan tree defies the wind, girt with its branches rooted round. He who is faithful to his friends doth all the rage of foes confound. Even though he thus discoursed, Sunanda did not recognize him and asked who he was. But as he approached the chariot, even before he saw the chariot and the ornaments which the prince wore, he recognized him, and as he looked at the prince, he recognized him, and falling at his feet and folding his hands, spoke this stanza. Come, I will take thee back, O prince, to thine own proper home. Sit on the throne and act the king. Why in this forest roam? The great being replied, I do not want that throne or wealth. I want no friends nor kin, since 'tis by evil acts alone that I that throne could win. The charioteer spoke, A brimful cup of welcome, prince, will be prepared for thee, and thy two parents in their joy great gifts will give it to me. The royal lives, the princes all, Vaisyas and Brahmins both, great presents in their full content will give me nothing loth. Those who ride elephants and cars, foot soldiers, royal guards, when thou returnest home again will give me sure rewards. It's funny how he's looking out for his own interests. The country folk and city folk will gather joyously, and when they see their prince returned will presents give to me. The great being spoke, By parents I was left forlorn, by city and by town. The princes left me to my fate, I have no home my own. My mother gave me leave to go, my father me forsook. Here in this forest wild alone, the ascetic's vow I took. As the great being called to mind his own virtues, delight arose in his mind, and in his ecstasy he uttered a hymn of triumph. Even to those who hurry not, the heart's longing wins success. Know, charioteer, that I today have gained ripe holiness. Even by those who hurry not, the highest end is won. Crowned with ripe holiness I go, perfect and fearing none. The charioteer replied, Thy words, my lord, are pleasant words. Open thy speech and clear. Why wast thou dumb when thou didst see father and mother near? The great being spoke, No cripple I for lack of joints, nor deaf for lack of ears. I am not dumb for want of tongue, as plainly now appears. In an old birth I played the king, as I remember well, but when I fell from that estate I found myself in hell. Some 20 years of luxury I passed upon the throne, but 80,000 years in hell did for that guilt atone. My former taste of royalty filled all my heart with fear. Thence was I dumb, although I saw father and mother near. My father took me on his lap, but midst his fondling play I heard the stern commands he gave, at once this miscreant slay. Saw him in sunder, go that wretch, impale without delay. Hearing such threats, well might I try, crippled and dumb to be, and wallow helplessly in filth, an idiot willingly. Knowing that life is short at best and filled with miseries, who against another for its sake would let his anger rise? Who on another for its sake would let his vengeance light? Through want of power to grasp the truth and blindness to the right. Then Sunanda reflected, This prince abandoning all his royal pomp as if it were carrion, has entered into the woods, unwavering in his resolve to become an ascetic. What have I to do with this miserable life? I too will become an ascetic with him. So he spoke this stanza. I too would choose the ascetic's life with thee. Call me, O prince, for I as thou would be. When thus requested, the great being reflected, If I at once admit him to the ascetic life, my father and mother will not come here, and thus they will suffer loss, and the horses and chariots and ornaments will perish. And blame will accrue to me, for men will say, He is a goblin, has he devoured the charioteer? So, wishing to save himself from blame and to provide for his parents' welfare, he entrusted the horses and chariots and ornaments to him and spoke this stanza. Restore the chariot first. Thou art not a free man now. First pay thy debts, they say, then take the ascetic's vow. The charioteer thought to himself, if I went to the city and he meanwhile departed elsewhere, his father and mother, on hearing my news of him, would come back with me to see him. And if they found him not, they would punish me, so I will tell him the circumstances in which I find myself, and will get his promise to remain here. So he spoke two stanzas. Since I have done thy bidding, prince, I pray, do thou be pleased to do what I shall say. Stay till I fetch the king, stay here of grace, he will be joyful when he sees thy face. The great being replied, well, be it as thou sayest, charioteer, I too would gladly see my father here. Go and salute my kindred all, and take a special message for my parents' sake. The man took the commands. He clasped his feet, and all due honor paid, started to journey as his master bade. At that moment Chanda Devi opened her lattice, and as she wondered whether there were any tidings of her son, and looked on the road by which the charioteer would return, she saw him coming alone and burst into lamentation. The Buddha described it thus. Seeing the empty car and lonely charioteer, the mother's eyes were filled with tears, her breast with fear. The charioteer comes back, my son is slain, yonder he lies, earth mixed with earth again. Our bitterest foes may well rejoice, alack, seeing his murderer come safely back. Dumb, crippled, say, could he not give one cry, as on the ground he struggled helplessly? Could not his hands and feet force thee away, though dumb and maimed while on the ground he lay? The charioteer spoke. Promise me pardon, lady, for my word, and I will tell thee all I saw and heard. The queen answered, pardon, I promise you for every word. Tell me in full whatever you saw or heard. Then the charioteer spoke. No cripple he is not deaf, his utterance clear and free. He played fictitious parts at home through dread of royalty. In an old birth he played the king, as he remembers well, but when he fell from that estate he found himself in hell. Some 20 years of luxury he passed upon the throne, but 80,000 years in hell did for that guilt atone. His former taste of royalty filled all his heart with fear. Hence was he dumb, although he saw his father and mother near. Perfectly sound in all his limbs, faultlessly tall and broad, his utterance clear, his wits undimmed, he treads salvation's road. If you desire your son to see... To see your son, then come at once with me. You shall behold Prince Tamia, perfectly calm and free. But when the prince had sent the charioteer away, he desired to take the ascetic vows. Knowing his desire, Saka sent Visakamma, saying, Prince Tamia wishes to take the ascetic vow. Go and make a hut of leaves for him and the requisite articles for an ascetic. Visakamma hastened accordingly, and in a grove of trees 3 leagues in extent, he built a hermitage, furnished with an apartment for the night and another for the day, a tank, a pit, and fruit trees, and he prepared all the requisites for an ascetic, and then returned to his own place. When the Bodhisattva saw it, he knew that it was Saka's gift, so he entered into the hut and took off his clothes and put on the red bark garments, both the upper and under, and threw the black antelope skin on one shoulder, and tied up his matted hair. And, having taken a carrying pole on his shoulder and a walking staff in his hand, he went out of the hut. Then he walked repeatedly up and down, displaying the full dress of an ascetic, and having shouted triumphantly, oh, bliss, oh, the bliss, returned to the hut, and sitting down on the ragged mat, he entered upon the 5 transcendent faculties, which are the 5 jhanas, or the 5 absorptions, 5 stages of meditation. Then, going out at evening and gathering some leaves from a kara tree nearby, he soaked them in a vessel supplied by Saka in water, without salt or buttermilk or spice, and ate them as if they were ambrosia. And then, as he pondered on the 4 perfect states, he resolved to take up his abode there. The 4 perfect states, I think, are the 4 Brahma-vihara, which are the states of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, which are a meditative state. You have to understand that he wouldn't be practicing vipassana or insight meditation yet because he hadn't come to the point where he could understand the truth. Meanwhile, the king of Kasi, having heard Sunanda's words, summoned his chief general and ordered him to make preparation for the journey, saying, "The horses to the chariot's yoke, bind girths on elephants and come. Sound conch and tabor far and wide, and wake the loud-voiced kettle drum. Let the hoarse tom-tom fill the air, let rattling drums raise echoes sweet. Bid all this city follow me, I go my son once more to greet. Let palace ladies, every prince, vaisyas and brahmins, every one, all have their chariot horses yoked, I go to welcome back my son. Let elephant riders, royal guards, horsemen and footmen, every one, let all alike prepare to go, I go to welcome back my son. Let country folk and city folk gather in crowds in every street, let all alike prepare to go, I go once more my son to greet." The charioteer thus ordered yoked the horses, and having brought the chariots to the palace gates, informed the king. The master, the Buddha, thus described it. Sindh horses of the noblest breed stood harnessed at the palace gates. The charioteers the tidings bring, the train, my lord, thy presence awaits. The king spoke, "Leave all the clumsy horses out, no weaklings in our cavalcade." Such were the royal orders given, and such the charioteers obeyed. The king, when he went to his son, assembled the four castes, the four classes, the 18 guilds and his whole army, and 3 days were spent in the assembling of the host. On the fourth day, having taken all that was to be taken in the procession, he proceeded to the hermitage, and there was greeted by his son, and gave him due greeting in return. The master has described it thus. His royal chariot then prepared, the king without delay got in and cried out to his wives, "Come with me all away." With yak's tail fan and turban crest and royal white sunshade, he mounted in the royal car with finest gold arrayed. Then did the king set forth at once his charioteer beside, and quickly came where Tamya all tranquil did abide. When Tamya beheld him come all brilliant and ablaze, surrounded by attendant bands of warriors, thus he says, "Father, I hope 'tis well with thee, thou hast good news to tell. I hope that all the royal queens, thy mothers, my mothers too, are well." "Yes, it is all well with me, my son, I have good news to tell. And all the royal queens, indeed, thy mothers, all are well. I hope thou drinkest no strong drink, all spirits dost eschew. To righteous deeds and almsgiving thy mind is ever true." "Oh yes, strong drink I never touch, all spirit I eschew. To righteous deeds and almsgiving my mind is ever true. The horses and elephants, I hope, are well and strong, no painful bodily disease, no weakness, nothing wrong." "Oh yes, the elephants are well, the horses well and strong, no painful bodily disease, no weakness, nothing wrong." "The frontiers as the central part, all populous at peace, the treasures and the treasuries quite full, say, what of these?" "Now welcome to thee, royal sir, oh welcome now to thee. Let them set out a couch, that here seated the king may be." The king, out of respect for the great being, would not sit upon the couch. The great being said, "If he does not sit on his royal seat, let a couch of leaves be spread for him." So he spoke a stanza. "Be seated on this bed of leaves, spread for thee as is meet. They will take water from this spot and duly wash thy feet." The king, in his respect, would not accept even the seat of leaves, but sat on the ground. Then the bodhisattva entered the hut of leaves, and taking out a kara leaf and invited the king, he spoke a stanza. "No salt have I, this leaf alone is what I live upon, O king. Thou art come here, a guest of mine, be pleased to accept the fare I bring." The king replied, "No leaves for me, that's not my fare. Give me a bowl of pure hill rice, cooked with a subtle flavor of meat, to make the pottage nice." At that moment the queen Chanda Devi, surrounded by the royal ladies, came up, and after clasping her dear son's feet and saluting him, sat on one side with her eyes full of tears. The king said to her, "Lady, see what thy son's food is," and put some of the leaves into her hand, and also gave a little to the other ladies, who took it, saying, "O my lord, dost thou indeed eat such food? Thou endurest great hardship," and sat down. The king said, "O my son, this appears wonderful to me, very strange to me." And he spoke a stanza. Most strange indeed it seems to me that thou, thus left alone, livest on such mean food, and yet thy color is not gone. The prince thus replied, Upon this bed of leaves strewn here I lie, and indeed alone. A pleasant bed it is, and so my color is not gone. Girt with their swords, no cruel guard stands sternly looking on. A pleasant bed it is, and so my color is not gone. Over the past I do not mourn, and for the future do not weep. I meet the present as it comes, and so my color keep. Mourning about the hopeless past or some uncertain future need, thus dries a young man's vigor up, as when you cut a fresh green reed. The king thought to himself, I will inaugurate him as king and carry him away with me. So he spoke these stanzas, inviting him to share the kingdom. My elephants, my chariots, horsemen and infantry, and all my pleasant palaces, dear son, I give to thee. My queen's apartments too I give, and all their pomp and pride. Thou shalt be sole king over us, there shall be none beside. Fair women skilled in dance and song, and trained for every mood, shall lap thy soul in ease and joy. Why linger in this wood? The daughters of thy foes shall come proud, but to wait on thee. When they have borne thee sons, then go an anchorite to be. Come, O my firstborn, and my heir, in the first glory of thine age, enjoy thy kingdom to the full. What dost thou in this hermitage? The Bodhisattva spoke. No, let the young men leave the world and fly its vanities. The ascetic's life best suits the young, thus counsel all the wise. This, of course, is the argument between whether one should live one's life first and then go and live in the forest as an ascetic. And the this was the idea of the Brahmins, that they would live their life and enjoy all pleasures, and then, when they were too old to enjoy the pleasures, then go out and live in the forest. And of course, Buddhism takes the opposite way of looking at things, that one is better off doing it when one is young, before one has soiled one's mind or made one's mind all clouded with defilements. No, let the young man leave the world a hermit and alone. I will embrace the hermit's life. I need no pomp nor throne. I watch the boy with childish lips. He, father, mother, cries. Himself begets a son, and then he too grows old and dies. So the young daughter in her flower grows blithe and fair to see. But she soon fades, cut down by death like the green bamboo tree. Men, women, all, however young, soon perish. Who, in sooth, would put his trust in mortal life, cheated by fancied youth? As night by night gives place to dawn, life still contracts its span, like fish in water which dries up. What means the youth of man? This world of ours is smitten sore, and is ever watched by one. They pass and pass with purpose fell, why talk of crown or throne? Who sorely smites this world of ours, who watches grimly by, and who thus pass with purpose fell? Tell me the mystery. 'Tis death who smites this world, old age who watches at our gate, and 'tis the nights which pass and win their purpose soon or late. As when the lady at her loom sits weaving all the day, her task grows ever less and less, so waste our lives away. As speeds the hurrying river's course, on with no backward flow, so in its course the life of men doth ever forward flow. And as the river sweeps away trees from its banks uptorn, so are the men by age and death in headlong ruin born. The king, as he listened to the great being's discourse, became disgusted at a life spent in a house, and longed to leave the world, and he exclaimed, I, too, will not go back to the city. I will become an ascetic here. If my son will go to the city, I will give him the white umbrella. So to try him, he once more invited him to take his kingdom. My elephants, my chariots, horsemen and infantry, and all my pleasant palaces, dear son, I give to thee. My queen's apartments, too, I give, with all their pomp and pride. Thou shalt be sole king over us. There shall be none beside. Fair women skilled in dance and song, and trained for every mood, shall lap thy soul in ease and joy. Why linger in this wood? The daughters of thy foes shall come proud, but to wait on thee. When they have borne these sons, then go and anchor it to be. My treasures and my treasuries, footmen and cavalry, and all my pleasant palaces, dear son, I give to thee, with troops of slaves to wait on thee, and queens to be embraced. Enjoy thy throne, all health to thee, why linger in this waste? But the great being replied by showing him how little he wanted a kingdom. Why seek for wealth? It will not last. Why woo a wife? She soon will die. Why think of youth? 'Twill soon be past, and threatening age stands ever nigh. What are the joys that life can bring? Beauty, sport, wealth, or royal fare? What is a wife or child to me? I am set free from every snare. This thing I know, where'er I go, fate, watching, never slumbereth. Of what avail is wealth or joy to one who feels the grasp of death? Do what thou hast to do today, who can ensure the morrow's sun? Death is the master general, who gives his guarantee to none. Thieves ever watch to steal our wealth, I am set free from every chain. Go back and take thy crown away, what want I with a king's domain? The great being's discourse, with its application, came to an end, and when they had heard it, not only the king and the queen Janda, but the 16,000 royal wives, all desired to embrace the ascetic life. The king ordered a proclamation to be made in the city by beat of drum, that all who wished to become ascetics with his son should do so. He caused the doors of his treasuries to be thrown open, and he had an inscription written on a golden plate, and fixed on a great bamboo as a pillar, that his treasure jars would be exposed in certain places, and that all who pleased might take of them. The citizens also left their houses with the doors open, as if it were an open market, and flocked round the king. The king and the multitude took the ascetic vow together before the great being. A hermitage erected by Sakka extended for 3 leagues. The great being went through the huts made of branches and leaves, and he appointed those in the center for the women, as they were naturally timid, while those on the outside were for the men. All of them on the fast day stood on the ground and gathered and ate fruits, the fruits of the trees which Visakhamma had created, and followed the rules of the ascetic life. The fast day, of course, is the Uposatha. It's not a fast day. It's a day of eating only in the morning. So they would still eat, but only eat in the morning. The great being, knowing the mind of every one, whether he indulged his thoughts in thoughts of lust or malevolence or cruelty, sat down in the air and taught the Dhamma, the truth, to each. And as they listened, they speedily developed the faculties and attainments of the ascetic of the meditation practice. A neighboring king, hearing that Kasiraja had become an ascetic, resolved to establish his rule in Benares. So he entered the city, and seeing it all adorned, he went up into the palace. And beholding the 7 kinds of precious stones there, he thought to himself that some kind of danger must gather round all this wealth. So he sent for some drunken revelers and asked them by which gate the king had gone out. They told him by the eastern gate, so he went out himself by that gate and proceeded along the bank to the river. The bank of the river. The great being knew of his coming and having gone to meet him, sat in the air and taught him the Dhamma, the truth. Then the invading king took the ascetic vow as well with all his company, and the same thing happened also to another king. In this way 3 kingdoms were abandoned. The elephants and horses were left to roam wild in the woods, the chariots dropped to pieces in the woods, and the money in the treasuries, being counted as mere sand, was scattered about in the hermitage. All the residents there attained to the 8 ecstatic meditations, and at the end of their lives became destined for the world of Brahma, the world of God, of the gods. Yea, the very animals, as the elephants and horses, having their minds calmed by the sight of the sages, were eventually reborn in the 6 heavens of the gods. The Buddha, having brought this lesson to an end, said, "Not now only, but formerly also did I leave a kingdom and become an ascetic." Then he identified the birth. The goddess in the umbrella was Upalavana, the charioteer was Sariputta. The father and the mother were the royal family, the court was the Buddha's congregation, and the wise Mugapaka was myself. Tamiya. After they had come to the island of Ceylon, Sri Lanka, Elder Kudakatisa, a native of Mangana, Elder Mahawangsaka, Elder Pusadeva, who dwelt at Katakandakara, Elder Maharakita, a native of Uparimandaka Mala, Elder Mahatisa, a native of Bagari, Elder Mahasiva, a native of Wamatapapara, Elder Mahamaliya Deva, a native of Vela. All these elders are called the late comers in the assembly of the Kudalaka birth, the Mugabaka birth, the Ayogara birth, and the Hattipali birth. Moreover, Elder Mahanaga, a native of Madda, and Elder Mali Yamakadeva remarked on the day of the Parinibbana, "Sir, the assembly of the Mugabaka birth is today extinct. Wherefore? I was then passionately addicted to spiritous drink, and when I could not bring those with me who used to drink liquor with me, I was the last of all to give up the world and become an ascetic." Thus ends the Taimiya birth. And that ends the talk for today. Thank you all for coming. Hope to see you all next time.